All right, what's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. What's up, man? How's day? I don't even know what day it is. 347,
I feel like.
340-something.
Yeah.
All the days are blending into each other right now, so I have zero clue how many days we've been living under these circumstances.
Yeah,
but
I mean, they've been blending together so hard we're a day late on the fucking podcast.
Yeah, it's completely blended in with each other. But yeah, how are things?
Holding up. Thankful that, you know, I still have work and, you know, I get to be busy during the day. I can only imagine, and I empathize with all the folks out there that are just sitting at home, you know, going through their third iteration of Friends, you know, or whatever streaming shit that they're watching these days. The Tiger King, I don't know, all that shit.
Did you watch Tiger King yet?
I watched the first episode. It was interesting.
It gets better. The first episode is just a peep show compared to what happens in the rest of the series. It's very interesting.
I mean, I heard bits and pieces of the podcast that came out before the show, so I definitely want to watch it, but you know, I swear if somebody else recommends the fucking Tiger King podcast to
me, I know.
You know,
like, I totally get that because about 50 people, I started watching it before anyone else recommended it to me, so I don't have that angst towards it. Mm-hmm. Like, I watched Don't Fuck with Cats.
Oh, I did too, and holy shit.
And
oh man.
It was kind of fun. It was really good, but it was kind of goofy at the same time. Like, to think of all these dorks on the internet going on and investigating this, which I find kind of funny at the same time. But Tiger Kings was like recommended and started playing right afterwards. So I was like, okay, this looks lighthearted.
He's
just this crazy gay redneck polygamist is playing with some cats. This seems pretty lighthearted, and then it eventually dives into something much darker, but. Mm-hmm. I do understand that your resentment towards a show that everyone recommends to you. I typically will do the same thing.
Yeah, seriously. And it seems like, you know, nowadays, you know, obviously when something goes viral on Netflix or one of the streaming services, everybody's talking about it. And, you know, if you haven't watched it yet, you might start getting annoyed by all the people telling
Free
you to watch
Joe.
It. You know? Yeah. So it's like, it's that, but it's like magnified with coronavirus because like literally millions of people have nothing better to do but watch shit, you know? So, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what people are doing with their spare time.
Let us know. We'd be interested.
Yeah, actually, don't let us know. I don't want to know. I'll tell you what I've been doing. I've started bird watching.
Bird watching?
Bird watching.
Pigeons?
No, man, you go to Central Park, the oasis of Manhattan, you can see a lot of stuff.
I saw a dove the other day in Bushwick.
Oh, a dove.
Yeah.
So he called himself Dove?
No.
No, I go to Central Park and I'll just go and I'll just like walk around like a hobo for like an hour and a half almost every day just to get out. And the other day I'm like, Central Park's pretty big. You know what I mean?
It's huge.
It's pretty big and it's pretty dense. There's a lot of there's a lot of like paths and shit inside the park, and there's a surprising amount of wildlife in there.
Yep.
Not like deer, but
like the Mandarin duck.
Yeah, there's the Mandarin duck that ended up there somehow. Someone probably released this Mandarin duck, but everyone was going wild over this Mandarin duck that's only native in Eastern Asia. It appeared on like 60th Street in Manhattan, and all these duck enthusiasts and photographers were following this duck around for months, and it was all over social media, and there was articles written about this duck, and finally I went to go see it, and the duck was pretty fascinating. The best part of it, though, was just watching all these people like so fascinated with this duck. As soon as it went close to them, as it started, like, you know, going or swimming towards, I guess, a little dock in the pond it was in, everyone starts going, like, shh, 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 no, no, don't scare it away, don't scare it away. But there was crowds of people watching this duck. What I was doing the other day, I was, like, walking around, and I was, like, I saw a cardinal, which is not, like, a very common appearance in the park. So I was like, oh, I'm going to take a picture of this cardinal. And I think I'm going to go take a picture of every single bird that's in Central Park. like every species of bird in Central Park. So that's what I'm doing with my time. I'm bird watching.
Nice.
The other day I ran into a raccoon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was only like 6:30 too.
Huh.
I don't know if that's a sign that it's a rapid or something, or with rabies.
No, I think it's just a sign of the fact that everyone's indoors now and nature is reclaiming its position on the world. Have you heard that?
Interesting.
Have you heard that? I don't know if I mentioned this on a previous podcast, but like one interesting like silver lining to this whole pandemic is that NASA has been recording, you know, the levels of CO2 over like countries on lockdown, and it's like dropping drastically. In Venice, the waters are becoming cleaner, and they've seen like dolphins and shit like outside of it, and like, you know, fish and like wildlife are coming back. So I think the raccoons are just like confused. They're like, wait, shouldn't there be people out? Let's go out and find some food.
Venice is smelling less like piss than it normally does.
I guess, you know,
it's a big toilet. Venice is gross. Yeah, I saw a raccoon, but then Central Park is pretty gross too, because I'm walking, I'm amazed by all this nature, there's less people, and then I walk up this path, and of course I walk into like a syringe and stuff. Like, not, I don't walk into a syringe, but I see a syringe on the ground, and I'm like, that really just took everything away. All the peace I had in my mind all just went outside the window after seeing that.
A little bit of context for your, like, you know, stroll through the park, your fantasy woodland, you know.
Right. I just saw Ricky the raccoon and Charlie the cardinal, and now I just bumped into, you know, a junkie's junkie's aftermath from 2 hours ago. No, yeah. So, but yeah, let's get into the actual topics of today. So, I guess the plan is to talk about things that have been going on that are not directly related to coronavirus. A lot of these things have been skipped over the news. Not that these things would probably be reported regardless, but I wanted to actually highlight something that I found pretty interesting, and I wish we tackled this last episode, but shit's going down in Africa right now.
To
say the least. And essentially what's going on is that Boko Haram is killing a lot of people. And what they did about a week ago on March 23rd, Boko Haram ambushed a Chadian military encampment by the Lake Chad region. And the Lake Chad is a freshwater lake, and it borders Chad, Cameroon, Nigeria, and Niger. 92 soldiers were killed in a 7-hour firefight. And it ended up being one of the deadliest attacks in Chadian military history. Now, in addition to that, Boko Haram killed 50 Nigerian soldiers the next day.
Right.
And a place in Nigeria, but it's located this is a borderland, you know.
Right. Around the Chad Lake area.
And they killed 50 soldiers. So in a span of about 2 days, or I think it was a 24-hour span, it might have been a little bit more than that, they killed 150 soldiers. That's a pretty huge deal.
That's massive.
In that context.
Yeah, that's massive.
If that were to happen in Yemen, if that were to happen in Syria, if that were to happen anywhere in Iraq, that would be considered a pivotal battle. And so when you see casualties that high, it's pretty alarming. And it's just one of those things that has really gone completely under the radar. I don't think most people have heard about that. I don't think most people know where most of these countries are, to be completely honest.
Yeah, totally. What I find really interesting, just to underscore, you know, this death toll, you know, Chad isn't necessarily like a big country that a lot of people are aware of, but Chad's not like a pushover state. They happen to be a pretty big ally, you know, to the West in general, specifically France. But you know, France has, you know, major operating bases in Chad where they do their campaigns in Africa to fight, you know, terrorists and shit. But you know, they're supplied by Western militaries, you know, the US specifically. You know, they've got our shit, you know, they have our tech. And, you know, this one facility was heavily fortified, right? And it was in It was like, kind of like an island, right? And the way that these guys snuck up on him, which is exactly what they did, they snuck up on him, is they took their boats and they sent him over, you know, in the morning. I think it was like 5 a.m. or something like that when they attacked. And they put, you know, their boats on just cruise, so they shut off the engines. And they came over real silently, almost like, you know, George Washington crossing the Delaware, kind of. And they basically cut off their exit points, you know, and then just lit them up. And the crazy part about this is that, you know, it's not just, hey, they killed a bunch of people, but now they also got their hands on a ton of tech, a ton of Western military tech. And this is very, very surprising because up until very recently, I think as recently as like January or so, like they were getting their, Boko Haram was getting spanked by Chadian warfighters, you know. So this, you know, marks a huge escalation in there, a kind of almost a turning point in the war. And, you know, the way that they did it, you know, it's ironic because Chad, I mean, we've done an episode on this, you know, the president of Chad is Idriss Deby Itno, and he's particularly famous for, you know, pioneering the Toyota War against Libya, you know. And, you know, in that instance, if you haven't listened to our episode on that, I highly recommend it. It's super interesting. But, you know, the TLDR for it was, you know, Chad and Libya are getting into a spat on a border territory. And Chad was, you know, the underdog in this situation. And they basically rigged up a bunch of Toyota trucks with like machine guns on the back, drove through the canyons and absolutely wiped the floor with the Libyans. And that's kind of what Boko Haram did to Chad. You know, they got on some boats, used whatever military stuff that they have, you know, whatever weapons and armaments, which in fairness was not as good as the Chadians. And through the use of asymmetric warfare, we're able to overtake this position and just wreck them.
Yeah, well, it was a turkey shoot. Yep. So they're shooting. They got him. They had him trapped, and they started shooting in both directions. And they really had no place to go or retreat.
Right.
And then just, you know, think about that with the smoke going up in the air and ammunition blowing up and all that, and it's pretty deadly. It was like what, the highway of death in the yep. Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
That's it's. I think what, like, I was looking at the map of that base, and it's like in a marshy area. So I would imagine it's pretty hard to, if you get stuck there, you're pretty much fucked. And right on a borderland where it's Boko Haram could just get out of there. But apparently, if they were there for 7 hours, you know, they didn't leave because of reinforcements. They left when they wanted to leave. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I feel like it's like, this is an interesting couple months, you know, year for asymmetric warfare. I mean, not too long ago, if you remember, the folks down in in Saudi, the Saudi Arabian brigades that got taken over
in Yemen, Houthis.
In Yemen, yeah, by the Houthis, right? So just handful of these guys, you know, in sandals basically taking over two brigades of mostly mercenaries, admittedly, but armed with Western weapons.
But a lot, I heard a lot of weapons are going, are seeping into Boko Haram from Syria now,
which
is probably true. That's what I heard. I haven't confirmed that at all, but I would imagine that is the case. Like a lot of, cause, I mean, Boko Haram is ISIS. You know what I mean?
Right, right. But it's just a different name. Yeah,
they're just a Nigerian offshoot of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, capturing girls and bartering them away like auctions and taking ransoms and doing all that crazy stuff. And
yeah, those guys are disgusting.
Yeah, they're terrorists. Really. They're terrorists. There's rumors that the Saudis fund them, which I wouldn't be surprised. But yeah, it's just another thing that's going on in the world that people don't really care to talk about because let's just face it. I think people are pretty immune. They're not immune to it, but they're numb to whenever they hear of a crisis in Africa, to be completely honest. I don't know if you feel the same way, but you hear, I think the general public, American public, they're just like, oh, it's Africa. Like, that's really sad, but, you know, it's all the way in Africa.
Right.
Kind of thing.
It's very unfortunate, too, because, you know, A lot of these things are products of, you know, I'm not going to say that we cause them, but, you know, Western countries exacerbate a lot of these issues. You know, Chad right now is in a really fucking tough spot. I mean, you know, they're located in one of the most dangerous areas in the world right now. In the north, they have Libya, which is in the middle of a civil war. You know, to the east, they have militias that control Darfur and the Sudan. In the west, obviously Boko Haram in Nigeria. It's in the northeast corner of Nigeria. You know, so they're kind of like, they're landlocked, right? They don't have access to water. And a big portion of their economy is oil. And if you've been following the news on, you know, the prices of oil, that's been dropping steadily. I think we're hovering somewhere around $20 a barrel. Which is crazy, because I feel like with the last time we talked about this, when we were talking about Saudi Arabia and Russia getting into a fight about it, it was like, what, $56 or something like that?
No, it was less than that. Last time we spoke about it, when we were talking about it, it was around $30 a barrel. Mm-hmm. That's when the price of oil initially dropped really, 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 really. We were talking about it when the price of oil just initially had that huge fall.
Right, and it's still going down. Yeah. You know, interesting point. You know, Chad was in a pretty bad depression a while back when the price of oil was around $36, right? So it being $20 right now is obviously not great for them.
To give you context, Chad is an oil exporter, but they're not a huge oil exporter.
But that's where a lot of their income comes from. You know,
I think they're like number 40 in the world as far as oil exporters. So they're not a huge oil exporter, but still, like, you know, governments like Chad, first of all, is the size of fucking, like, half of Europe. Like,
right.
All
it's
these
massive
countries,
mm-hmm.
You ever, Mercator maps they don't really do Africa justice about how large these countries are.
Right.
If you take the Congo, for example, and you compared it, if you threw it in the United States or in North America, it would stretch from southern Texas all the way to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
These are humongous countries, but that are scarcely populated with hundreds of ethnic groups and languages. And
I think there's like 200 ethnic groups right now in Chad, right?
Yeah, and the borders are drawn. They're just lines around resources. You know what I mean? They're not actual borders. Like African countries, they primarily speak French or English. You know, French and English are typically the national languages.
I wouldn't say that. I would say that they speak hundreds of regional dialects.
That's a better way to phrase it.
But their common languages, and specifically in Chad, would be things like English and French.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it. Like, they speak hundreds of languages, but the common languages are, you know, the former colonial state languages, English and French. But if you listen to like African news or something like that, or when they have an expert on, they're either speaking French or English, you know. It's like kind of like the educated language down there. But it's like, it brings up the question, like, because we don't talk about Africa too much on this podcast, and we probably should talk about it more. But I think the question is, like, why is Africa so impoverished? That's like a taboo question for a lot of people, because it's like, they jump to the conclusion if you ask that question. You're like, oh, are you going into like a race thing right there?
Right.
Which some people do. I don't really think it's a question of race at all.
No.
I can say
with absolute certainty it has nothing to do with race.
I agree with that. But regardless, there's this question, you know, there's, if you listen to a lot of, I guess they call themselves race realists. Oh, no. Race real? I am not racist. I'm just a race realist.
Yeah, I think this is a load of horseshit. if we're going to be real frank, I don't think there's a single reason why, you know, a lot of these countries in Africa are impoverished, but I think there is a common thread, and it's corporatism, it's globalism, you know, so. One thing to keep in mind is that pre-World War II, Africa was heavily colonized by a number of nations, mostly European. And, you know, in colonialization of Africa. I wish we had Danny Scherson on, because, you know, this is like, you know, his cup of tea now. You know, in the colonialization of Africa, the play was that they would import, you know, white European people into, you know, the countries that they were occupying, and they would set up basically a class system where the indigenous peoples, the locals, were basically second class, and they, you know, served the white classes. You know, if we want to go racist, but let's call a spade a spade. You know, that's the systems that they set up, and they took advantage of their resources, and they took advantage of the, you know, of the people. You know, World War II happens, and then, you know, a lot of that just becomes undone, and a lot of countries decide to stop officially colonializing Africa. Now, it took, you know, each country longer to gain their independence, you know, from their previous colonial overlords, let's call them. But, you know, they never really got back to, you know, true sovereignty. And here's why. Rather than doing pure colonialism, what now is happening is, you know, corporations are quasi-colonializing these African nations. And here's how they're doing it. So let's say I am a, you know, Dutch copper mining company, right? So I'll come in to a country like Chad, and whether through pressure or through bribery or, you know, whatever, I gain access to, you know, a copper mine dirt cheap. And then I mine the copper, and I employ, you know, people from Chad at, you know, inhumane rates, you know, probably don't care very much about, you know, OSHA or like operational safety hazards. You know, we're doing it as cheap as possible to get as much as possible. And we take these natural resources and we ship them back to, you know, the Netherlands. And then, you know, at that point, now my company creates something out of this copper, and it's in most cases something that's needed or useful to the African country that I've quasi-colonialized, and I'm going to sell it back to them at a pretty hefty markup. And, you know, they're already not great on their GDP, and we're already taking a lot of their resources, so they can't, you know, utilize their own resources to have enough money. So they need money now to purchase the goods that they need from the resources that we took and created. And to make matters worse, in many cases, you know, the corporations will then set up some, you know, some banks, some loans, right? And they'll loan the country some money at a very high, almost predatory rate of interest. And that kind of sets up a circle of debt that they can't get out of. And so in order to satisfy that debt, they try to lease out more of their land and give away more of their natural resources, because they need money to pay their debts, because they needed the goods that were being sold to them that were made from the products that from the raw materials that they were leasing out in the first place, you know. And, you know, I guess it's, you know, when you look at it that way, it makes you think, like, well, why did they do it in the first place? But, you know, it's just corruption, you know, and they never really had a great opportunity to establish, you know, themselves and set up their own economies independent of, you know, Western influence that was, frankly, not in their interest.
Yeah, I think you said that really well, as far as how predatory loans and a lot of how there is a new form of colonization that goes on in Africa that's not necessarily from a nation state, like physically putting a gun to their head, but through, you know, through the World Bank and the IMF and through You know, basically they export their natural resources, and they use, in which they in turn use that money to buy finished goods from their own natural resources.
Correct. Right.
Which is a recipe for complete disaster.
Right.
Like there's no way a country can become wealthy by practicing those economic policies. It's a nexus between predatory lending, corruption within the government, because a lot of these governments are ran by despots.
Right.
For example, the president of Chad is a despot.
Right.
He is a polygamist who has multiple wives.
He does so for political reasons too, you know, to try to get as many people on board with his agenda.
Yeah, he's a polygamist with multiple wives.
He's been around for like 30 years.
Who's been president for 30 years.
Yeah.
Who has crackdowns on political opponents. And most of these African governments are incredibly corrupt. It's almost like mind-blowingly corrupt. Like Africa and the Middle East, like Iraq, are like the staples of Ukraine, like a lot of countries in Eastern Europe too. Like Ukraine's super corrupt. Iraq is very corrupt. Nigeria is incredibly corrupt. You ever hear the story about the snake, how the snake ate all that money?
No, tell me.
So I just pulled it up while you were talking because I wanted to bring it up. So a millions of dollars in Nigeria went missing, and the clerk responsible said the snake ate it.
What?
Yeah.
What snake?
Millions of dollars went missing. The snake ate it. Where did it go? The snake ate it.
A snake?
The snake ate it. You really need to look for those, for that. You need to look hard for that level of corruption. But I mean, you could really just kind of pick any of them, and you'll find the same level of just salesmanship leaders. Because a lot of these leaders are just salesmen. You know, they're getting elected through just promising population something and really just taking all the money for themselves, or through political alliances, ravaging up hate for another ethnic group is a very popular one.
Mm-hmm.
Using some type of ethnic nationalism,
right,
and that's the condition in like ethnic nationalism. Typically, so there's two types of nationalism that you typically see. You know, there's civic nationalism, or I think a lot of scholars who study nationalism would probably kind of characterize it. There's civic nationalism, which we have in America, what you would find a lot in Western Europe, where there's a combination of all these ethnicities, you know, to be under, you know, to fly under the banner of the nation state, you know, whether that's America or France or England or really whatever. Most nation states have some degree of, like, you know, a look into their heritage, you know, like, you know, the U.S., a lot of people in the U.S., they look at their Anglican heritage or their British heritage, but, you know, at the end of the day, we're all Americans, you know what I mean? Like, neither of us is more American than the other one.
Right.
You know, and you're Puerto Rican and Palestinian, and I'm Irish and Polish.
Right.
You know, we're still the same level. We're still the same level of American, regardless.
Right.
For Eastern Europe and Central Europe, especially during the 1800s, a different type of nationalism took place. This is not all of it, but like a form of ethnic nationalism more so took place. Ethnic nationalism is usually, you can tell when there's an ethnic nationalism, when there's this story of it, when there's like a humiliation story, and when there's like pseudo heritage stories. When an ethnic group or a nation tries to trace back ethnic heritage to like a really, really long point of time.
Right.
Like, oh, like the Germans, we can trace our heritage back to the Teutonic Knights who slayed dragons. You know what I mean?
yeah, totally.
The Middle East is very, there's a lot of ethnic nationalism that goes on in the Middle East. And that goes on in Africa as well. And you really can't expect that process of civic nationalism to really ever take place. Because those borders were artificial borders that were drawn around resources by, you know, the former colonial powers rather than like legitimate states that formed. Again, Africa's a humongous continent with these humongous countries land-wise that are bigger much bigger land-wise than all these European states, with loads of resources, with scattered populations that speak millions of languages. So that nation-building process never really can really take place. And a lot of that is, like, you know, the race realist. Well, the reason why they weren't able to do that is because of the difference between IQ. You see, my ancestors, they were the children of the Enlightenment and built a steam engine. Oh, which I think is dumb, because it's such a dumb argument, because the scientific capital moved around the world all throughout
many
history.
Many times over, yeah.
Many times. Mm-hmm. So, like, now the scientific capital is in Asia.
Right.
You know, it's it was in Baghdad during the 1200s. It was in Egypt. It was in Alexandria. At that time, the people of Europe were essentially like raiding castles, and you know, before that, they were still living in caves when these great civilizations in the Middle East and Persia were going about.
Right. It moves around, man. It moves around. And, you know, to a point that you made earlier that I wanted to expose a little bit more is that, you know, what's happening right now in a lot of these African countries, but this isn't limited to just African countries, you know, a lot of places with corruption, this applies, where, you know, they'll utilize the kind of very diverse sectarian divides within the nation state to cause, you know, tension. And so when one despotic leader claims power, they'll pit multiple, you know, tribes or ethnic peoples against one another, so that they're fighting one another so that they can remain in power, you know? And in this case, the president of Chad, as you mentioned before, has a ton of wives, you know, and part of the reason why he does is because, you know, if he marries the daughter of some, you know, tribal or ethnic leader, you know, then they form an alliance. You know, it's very Game of Thrones, you know. And, you know, if he gets enough of the good ones on his side, then, you know, he can keep his power and remain that way. And so, you know, they utilize this process, you know, of, you know, the nature of this, as you point out, very artificially drawn border, you know. And they use the fact that, you know, there is so much diversity in culture and in ethnicity and in language to their advantage. And frankly, so does the rest of the world, right? Because there's no, as you point out, civic nationalism going on, you know, within these very heterogeneous countries. And by heterogeneous, I mean like multiple tribes and sects. They're not able to really get together to find common ground and find, you know, common interest, because they're pitted against one another purposefully. And, you know, one way, and this is coming back to, you know, the reasons why, you know, some of these African countries are so poor and how it has to do with corporatism, is, you know, the military-industrial complex. In this case, it's pretty easy to sell this group or that group a bunch of arms. And then, you know, if you're an investor, a hedge fund, right, that's investing in Raytheon or Boeing or, you know, Lockheed Martin, you know, these people that are creating the weapons, you know, it's in your interest that people start fighting each other, right? Because then they'll want to buy weapons, right? They'll have no choice. It's either buy them or die, you know? And, you know, the military-industrial complex is happy to legitimately sell them weapons. All they need is just a little bit of chaos. And as I mentioned before, there's a lot of different types of people, you know, in sparsely populated areas, in a massive country with no strong civic nationalism, with despotic leaders that are more than willing to throw their people under the bus to make a buck, you know? So all of this kind of adds up to why it's very, very difficult to make, you know, a strong and prosperous economy in countries like these, especially, you know, they're really writhing in pain from colonialism, from, you know, decades of colonialism.
And a lot of this is because of, so there's two things. There's geography, and I think geography is like the biggest point. I would encourage people to read Thomas Sowell on this subject. He is my favorite writer when it comes to why different countries or different areas have prospered. A lot of it just has to do with the flat out geography. Like, is a state close to the water? Is it landlocked? Is it close to rivers? Are there trading ports? That is, right. Those are the main factors when it comes to a successful state or country or really what leads to good economic policy. A big reason why a lot of these countries are poor is not just, I mean, there's a lot of reasons, and I think we nailed a couple of them. The kind of the neo-colonialism that does go on, mostly in Europe right now. Africa is Europe's playground more so than the U.S., and
it's also China's playground, actually.
Yeah,
too.
It's China's playground.
Touch that. Yeah.
Yeah, China and Europe use Africa as their kind of like their sandbox, and the U.S. uses Latin America and the Middle East as their sandbox. But a lot of it is just because of their own economic policies are bad.
Right.
They don't have sound economic policies, and this is pretty much a characteristic of most LCDs. LDCs, like lower developed countries.
Right.
They will typically either be, their development policies are usually either centered around like agro export led growth, which many underdeveloped countries have a competitive advantage in. They'll have a competitive advantage in growing a particular crop. And what ends up happening, though, is that the domestic market is really limited due to the poverty of the local population.
Right.
Therefore, development can only be achieved by producing and reinvesting profits into industry. And in the past, reliance on agro exports was really commonly associated with colonialism. So, like, for example, like the cotton export to Europe was expanded during British colonial rule in Egypt and Sudan, while wine production was introduced to North Africa. And the agro export strategy faced like a lot of problems, such as like declining terms of trade for products and just favoring certain classes and excessive taxation. And that's just like one of them. And that's just like one strategy that they'll use. Also, they'll use mineral export-led growth. And in the Middle East, for example, there's really not too many minerals. In Africa, there's a lot of minerals.
Yep, a whole lot of them. Have you heard of blood diamonds?
Yeah. But the problem is that these are finite resources, and in international prices, they change.
Right, and they're affected by so many different variables, right? So, in the case of oil, as an example, with Chad, right? Chad, is like the 40th largest exporter of oil, so not like the biggest by any stretch. But for them, oil is their cash crop, so to speak. And a pandemic like coronavirus now disrupts that, global demand for it. And, suddenly you're fucked, And if you're another LDC, another lower developed country, and you now grow wheat, but suddenly there's a plague of locusts that threatens to eat all your crops, which is, by the way, happening right now, you're fucked. they're not particularly diversified economies. And, in one way, the critics of countries like these, could point out that, well, why aren't they diversifying their economies? Well, it's not just that simple, right? Not everybody can spring up out of nowhere after being colonized, for decades and decades, can just spring up a Western style, super diverse economy, just at the drop of a hat,
That extreme measure, like Saudi Arabia and their strategy of oil development,
mm-hmm.
That only really works with a country like Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, mm-hmm. where they have such massive oil reserves that they're able to build up large reserves of wealth and have that as savings for when the price of oil does eventually drop, because the price of oil will always drop and rise. And they, there's a big difference between Saudi Arabia and Chad as far as exporting oil. Like,
right.
One is Saudi Arabia is number one. It's very incredibly wealthy compared to Chad and most countries in Africa and the Middle East. And, you know, Chad is mainly impoverished. The issue, though, with Saudi Arabia is that they're, and this goes with all countries that are mineral export, you know, they have mineral export-led growth. Typically, that creates huge welfare systems. Mineral exporting, it's a highly capital intensive. It's
right. You need millions of dollars to set up a mine, as an example. Billions of dollars to set up a mine.
It's billions of dollars and millions of dollars to set these up, and the labor machinery does all this. So it's not going to employ a large group of people. So there's really no incentive to develop human capital. So what happens is that in Saudi Arabia, for example, and this is something that's going to bite them in the ass in the future, starting to bite them in the ass right now, is that they don't have a very qualified workforce.
Right.
Saudi workers are known to be lazy. You know, it's, you know, they rather hire outside for a company in Saudi Arabia. And usually when you create these welfare systems, or these huge, let's just call them welfare systems. That's what they are. Like, Saudi Arabia is a big welfare state. But when you do that in a country with really high unemployment, you're giving that power to a salesman dictator to really pick and choose who they, you know, based off really a transaction that will keep them in power, who they're going to distribute that wealth to. So that's another problem with these mineral export led countries. Now, there is a development strategy that has been used in the past in countries like Egypt and Turkey, and it worked to some degree. And essentially what it is, it's designed to move economies traditionally dependent on the export of primary commodities and raw materials to an industrial footing.
Right.
And new industries are expected to produce goods that were previously imported and process their own domestic raw material.
Correct.
Like, the result, in theory, would be economic diversification, and it would reduce the dependency on volatile external markets for primary products.
Right.
And that would start with, you know, it would be start with domestic products and wage increases. And
it also increases the skill sets of the workers themselves, right? Because now that generates a demand for their own human capital.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's what Egypt did in the 60s, in early with Nasser, when he took power. He envisioned like this really massive textile sector using Egyptian cotton, and that would completely release foreign imports. And that would link back to investing into advanced machinery. So, you know, the profits they would get from the textile sector, they would then use that to invest in their, you know, their spinning and weaving machinery. But here's the thing, though. That doesn't really work, though, because in order to do that, new industries need to be protected by foreign competition.
Right.
And this ends up just creating monopolies in a sector,
right,
meaning a higher cost for similar imports and lower quality goods.
Right.
So, like, import substituting industrialization, what that does is it ends up being a form of cronyism. At the end of the day,
absolutely,
because it relies on tariffs, and it relies
100%. You're 100% right. You know, because you're going to need to, you need a good political climate to get some like an idea like this done. You know, and these, you know, LDCs like Chad don't have a very good political climate that would be set up to not create cronyism and monopolies, right? Right now, and frankly, this isn't is strictly a internal issue. It's also external pressure that keeps it that way, right? It is in the interests of the corporations that go in to lease the the lands to take the resources to then create the goods and sell it back to the same country, you know, they have financial interests to make sure that that their operation stays in power and that they don't, you know, get pushed out by, you know, internal industry, right? Like what we're describing, like what Nasser did in the 60s with Egypt, right? These companies are going to be investing heavily in the politicians, in the leaders of those countries that are going to be favorable to their interests.
Well, we know what it also does, though. It also develops into regional scapegoating, because the public resources is typically not enough, so they end up having to tax the agriculture sector for this, and this ends up being turning into regional scape zoning to rural populations, mm-hmm. which will further divide the country.
Right, in an already very divided, you know, situation.
And these industries are too capital intensive to provide jobs to those rural workers. So there's really no win for the agriculture sector.
Yeah, it's a damn shame. So, you know, this is, you know, it's funny, Henry, I'm having a lot of fun talking about just like financial politics and economic politics of Africa. You know, I don't think we've ever touched this subject before.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever talked about this before.
It's kind of interesting shit.
We were not planning on talking about this whatsoever.
Yeah, it just kind of turned into that.
Yeah. But yeah, like it's really hard to, like, what do you do? Like, where do you start? Because all the development strategies that have really been used, there's other ones as well. There's growth led by agriculture development. And that's really for poor countries, like really, really impoverished countries. That would be a strategy that would be used in a country like Yemen. Agriculture development is the only way.
Yeah, but that's also not foolproof, because in Yemen, we covered this, you know, while we were covering the war in Yemen, there was a giant plague of locusts, you know? So if you have an agriculture-based economy, right, and what amounts to an act of God, or, you know, for the atheists out there, just a natural disaster, you know, it completely disrupts it, right? So, you know, in order to grow crops, you need the correct conditions. If there's a drought, you're fucked. If there's a plague of locusts, you're fucked. And if there's geopolitical issues like a war, you're fucked, you know? And if you're like Chad and you're landlocked and you can't necessarily export things, you're also fucked, you know? So it's a good idea for some, but it doesn't work for all.
Well, there's a big problem with you can try to develop growth by increasing your manufactured exports, but that ends up not being a politically convenient tool for a despot, because it requires the reduction of tariffs, and it also devaluates the devaluation will cause prices to skyrocket for the urban consumer. So,
and that's not a very popular, you know,
yeah,
position.
It's not really popular.
Cost of bread goes up, everyone's going to riot, you know?
So that's kind of what you're dealing with.
Right.
And a lot of these apply to, like, not just Africa, but
to any LDC,
most,
really. Yeah.
Most countries that are developing right now, there's mm-hmm. a nexus between just economic quagmires, because the right economic decisions that, you know, they probably should make are not politically popular. Then there's also, you know, there's foreign wars as well, which right. is another thing. It's not as much in Africa as it is in the Middle East, but there's still that avenue. And then there's predatory lending with corruption. It's just a whole nexus of all these things, and
right,
it's tough.
So what
I don't what do you say, what do you do?
I was gonna say that, but like, what have we learned in the last 40 minutes of talking about, you know, African economic policy? And I think it's, you know, undoubtedly has nothing to do with race and has nothing to do with like this bullshit IQ nonsense, right? Hopefully you've learned a couple things by, you know, hearing us out on this.
Well, the reason why it's so such a dumb argument is because, all right, why don't we apply that same logic to North and South Korea?
Mm-hmm.
So one country is awesome. Like, it has one of the largest economies in the world. Right. South Korea is ninth largest economy in the world.
Yep.
I think it's nine or so.
It's up there.
It's very high up there. They're making cell phones. They're making computers. They're making weird music videos. And North Korea, it's pitch black at night. Like, yeah. The craziest picture that you can see that, like, shows...
The satellite photos?
The satellite picture of South Korea and North Korea. South Korea is vibrant, and there's lights, and there's civilization, and North Korea is completely darked out.
It's like a bunch of nothing.
Mm-hmm. Because one country practices sound economic principles. South Korea did have their really bad times.
Of course.
They had their really bad times in the 60s and 70s, but they eventually rose out of it. You know, there was a shitload of corruption that was then taking place in the government. They were not always South Korea of today.
Right. Well, and also North Korea ravaged by war too. So, you know,
yeah. North Korea was doing you know, well compared to how they're doing now, is because they were receiving a lot of foreign aid from the Soviet Union at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But now North Korea is a communist fascist hellhole, and South Korea is great in world standards.
Yep, they're awesome.
They're the exact same race.
Right.
With the exact same IQ levels.
Yeah.
Everything has to do with the economic policies that have taken place and like what the governments that have been in charge and whether they were
internal, external yeah. factors, you know.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
So it's like, I just don't get these race arguments. Like, I've never been a fan of it. And you know, a lot of these people who do it, it's like these losers, these kids who are like, oh, my ancestor, my ancestor's skin color was the same as the guy who made the cotton gin or the guy who made the steam engine, therefore I'm entitled to all this praise. Like, what?
You know, it's funny.
Where did that entitlement come from?
If they took like a DNA test, like a bunch of them might end up, you know, surprised at how many different races they're represented by. But that's a different topic.
Well, the thing about Europeans is that Europe has been invaded so many times, mm-hmm. that is very, very diverse. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't even really know what it is.
Right.
It's we need to do a podcast on the rise of the nation state, because I think that's an important thing to really cover.
Yeah.
I was trying to talk about it earlier, but we talked about it
a little bit during 30 Years' War, you know, right at the end. We talked about it a little bit with the French Revolution, you know. But yeah, maybe we can do kind of an overview there.
The rise of the nation state would be an interesting podcast, because I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say wrong information, but a lot of people don't think about what a nation is, like what the nation state is, and mm-hmm. like the process that it took to form a nation. Because I said this in the 30 Year War podcast, that if you took somebody from the 1500s or the 1600s, you put them in a time machine and you brought them to the United Nations, they would be like, what the hell is the United Nations? Like, what's a nation? They wouldn't know what a nation was.
Right.
Because back in the day, they were more loyal to their tribal or village heritage rather than to the state.
Right, or monarchic, right. Mm-hmm.
These nation states didn't really start rising until the 1700s and 1800s. Like, there wasn't these mass education movements where everyone was speaking the same language and there was this like national heritage type thing going on that traced their roots back to like the Bourbons and stuff like that. Like, those were what ended up really happening is that, like, in France and England and these like capital urban cities, the intellectual class used the language spoken in these urban centers, and they kind of spread that out to the rest of the country and to form a national identity.
Mm-hmm.
And what it took massive amounts of propaganda to do it. Like, in reality, that's what it was. It took mass, like, these stories of national identity in these, like, you know, these historians writing about some type of culture unity to unify, you know, village A where they speak, you know, one language, and in village B where they speak another language. Like, there was a process that wasn't natural that had to take place, that was completely artificial, that took place. And this happened in Europe in the 1800s. It hasn't really happened in Africa. Like, that's like kind of really what it comes down to. And it's a lot harder to go down in Africa because African countries are way bigger and they're more diverse and they're sparsely populated. They don't have those rivers, those natural rivers to connect everyone together. So it's just a combination of like so many different things. But if you're debating the race and IQ thing, I think the best example, I think North and South Korea is like the greatest example to test that, you know, to kind of debunk that one race is smarter than another race.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so let's dive into that into another show later on. I think that would be a really interesting topic to like really hit. I'm actually reading a couple of interesting books on it. That's why I've kind of been like thinking about this type of stuff lately. One of the books you actually sent to me,
yep,
which I will not name on the show.
Right.
But I wanted to talk about, I wrote down some strange news, you shared some stories too, about some kind of weirder news that's been going on. That's for kind of related to COVID-19. You know, we both wanted to go as far as possible without talking about COVID as the main crux of the podcast, but you know, it's such a huge thing. It obviously requires attention. So let's talk about some weird stuff that's going on.
All right. Where should we start?
Let's see. Where's my freaking... I'm looking at the wrong Google sheet. You start. I got to pull up my notes.
Okay. Well, the one that I found super interesting was the news about the, you know, USS Theodore Roosevelt, the, you know, nuclear-powered supercarrier, and how they got a bit of spat of coronavirus there. Did you hear about this news?
Yeah, you sent me the article. That's very... So what exactly happened? So the commanding officer?
Yeah, so we'll get to the commanding officer in a second. So the setup for this is that, you know, something like 100 people got infected on this ship. And I found this super interesting because we talked at length months ago about supercarriers. And, you know, to give a quick TLDR, these things are floating islands, right? Like, they house 5,000 airmen, hundreds of airplanes and other military equipment, more guns than you can think of. And they roll deep with, you know, support ships and things like that. And this particular vessel was... I think stationed in Vietnam just before they started getting their first outbreak of coronavirus. And, you know, the thing about that is maybe they got it from Vietnam, but also it's pretty hard to track how they did it because they have, you know, aircraft coming on and off of this ship regularly to resupply, change out, you know, seamen, all kinds of shit, right? So it could have came from anywhere.
Semen,
semen. But for real, like it could have came from anywhere. So like trying to figure out exactly where it came from is almost like a futile exercise. The point though is that an aircraft carrier is like, it's like New York City, right? It is super densely populated, super close quarters. You know, we're talking about hallways that are like maybe 5 feet wide. We're talking about, in order to, you know, man certain aspects of, you know, the ship, you are literally right on top of one another. You know, we got people sleeping in bunks, you know, thousands of people sleeping on bunks, you know, dozens in particular rooms, you know, people sharing bathrooms and showers and all kinds of stuff, plenty of surfaces. And the damn ship is made of like steel. So like, you know, if you've been reading about like what surfaces, you know, COVID-19 can survive on, you know, those like nice smooth ones are pretty conducive for the virus, you know. So it became a problem really, really fast, right? And also it's a particularly big problem because this is like several $1 billion, you know, ship with even more billions of dollars of equipment on it. And it is the, you know, military might of the United States, which is by and large the most powerful in the world. And suddenly it's at risk of getting, you know, being incapacitated because of the coronavirus, right? So like coronavirus does not discriminate. You know, we might have the best guns, but can't do shit against the virus. And so that's kind of the setup of this, right? It's becoming a clusterfuck. And, you know, the commander of this ship, Captain Brett Crozier, he wrote what many people will probably describe as a scathing report to his superiors. And, you know, he wrote that we need to do something about this shit. And I'm trying to pull up this quote because it's pretty strong. Let's see. All right. I can see the quote from here, but it's not like the full, this is good enough. All right. All right. So Brett Crozier, he wrote to his superiors, and this is a part of the quote. He says, "We're not at war. Sailors do not need to die." And this was, you know, his plea to his commanders to, you know, do more, and to basically evacuate the ship, you know, cleanse it down, so that they can get back to operating, capability. And, you know, he was very recently, the news today is that he was relieved of his command, and it raises a bunch of eyebrows. And I think, you know, obviously this guy, Brett Crozier, he
had wrong think.
Yeah, I have no idea how else to put this. Like, what else do you do when your massive floating ship that's super conducive to spreading contagion is exhibiting signs of a spread of a virus that is very deadly? You know, like,
he was so right. He was so right. And he nailed it so hard that they had no choice but to relieve him from duty, because it would be an embarrassment to keep him on board knowing that he said something that was so strikingly true. Like,
you know,
like, now, isn't this kind of dumb that we're sailing around the world right now in a big virus infected ship?
Yeah. I mean, so
they're like, the guy's got a point. Fire that man.
I mean, like, okay, so people on one side are saying that this is like whistleblower retaliation, and it certainly sounds like that. But the bullshit reason that I think is bullshit, but the bullshit reason that, you know, the Pentagon is saying is that they let him go due to extremely poor judgment, right? And I guess this might be fair criticism, but I don't know if this is extremely poor judgment. The dude CC'd on this email something like 30 people, you know, 30 people who I assume are, you know, his superiors or people related to his superiors, like people that needed to know. And I think that the judgment, the extremely poor judgment here, was that he should have sent this to fewer people so that it wouldn't get leaked. Now, so far, everyone, you know, on the military side is saying that, you know, we don't think that Crozier leaked it himself. Like, that's not a question, I think. What I think they are trying to make the case for is that he should have limited the number of people that he sent this message to. And that would have reduced the, you know, risk of it being leaked to the public. And, you know, that caused a firestorm and like a lot of blowback, and, you know, basically he caused trouble, you know, for them. And so that was extremely poor judgment. But like, dude, in his defense, he thought his sailors were gonna die for something that's totally preventable, you know?
No, it's common sense. I don't know if he thought all of the sailors were going to die.
Well, even if some of his sailors die, that is unacceptable. And even more importantly, even if some of them die and more of them are sick, then that disrupts the operations of the ship, right? We're talking about, again, billions of dollars of ship, even more billions of dollars of equipment, and a pivotal point, one of 11, a pivotal point in the U.S. military. Can you imagine if, like, I don't know, all of the, you know, or a good percentage of the people who operate the United States's, you know, nuclear weapons capability couldn't do their job? Or even more importantly, what if the U.S.'s air traffic control, you know, all became sick, or some large percentage of them became sick, which, you know, was to the detriment of air traffic all over? You know, like, this is, he was right, in my opinion. This was 100% the right move. And the military are mad that the press found out about it, and they got all embarrassed about it. And they didn't like it, so they canned him. They shit canned him.
I think it sounds like he got fired because he made someone look stupid.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
I think that's what it sounds like to me, mm-hmm. based off the emailing drama and stuff like that.
Right.
And you know how things go, like, oh, you CC'd the wrong person on that email. You said something.
But her emails, though.
It sounds like, you know, from where you and I are sitting, it sounds perfectly reasonable. But, you know, the politics that's going on within the rank and file, I guess it's a different story. You don't know whose shoes he stepped on.
At least 30 of them, I guess, right?
All it took was probably one.
Yeah.
The one wrong person.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. But I mean, now the ship is stationed in Guam. I think they removed like 1,000 of the 5,000. I also think that, you know, in fairness, what he was proposing was pretty extreme. He was suggesting that they leave kind of a skeleton crew of 500 people on board the ship. And based on what I'm reading here, it would probably take more than 500 people to, you know, maintain the ship. But you got to remember, this thing is nuclear powered, right? You don't want to let this thing sit by itself, you know, requires.
It sounds like the beginning of a Tom Clancy novel.
Seriously.
Nuclear powered ship.
Seriously,
with only skeleton crew.
But
that's when Somalian pirates take it over. No, more like it'd be like Russian operatives loyal to Joseph Stalin, trying to bring back the Soviet, the communist government
by stealing a nuclear powered aircraft carrier that was
Metal Gear.
Yeah, yeah, no, it does sound like a Tom.
I swear I don't have Corona. Or do I?
Who knows?
I am in New York. Yeah, that sounds like Metal Gear.
I don't know. Interesting story.
One of the Metal Gears took place in a aircraft carrier, right?
I think so. I didn't play them all, so possibly. Oh,
I love Metal Gear. It's one of my guilty pleasures.
I used to love watching people play Metal Gear. Like my brother had it. I think it was like Metal Gear 3. And I didn't even play it.
That's
I,
the best.
I just like watched it.
Metal Gear Solid 3, the third one,
yeah.
When I think he's in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I don't think they actually named the country he's in, but it's supposed to be Vietnam. It's Snake's father, mm-hmm. who's his clone. It's so funny because it's exactly what I would expect from, like, a Japanese, a really creative Japanese, storyteller
yeah
on their take on American, like, you know, the American military industrial complex. Like it's
the game
just
plays
so
like
bizarre
a manga, you know.
Yeah. If you took the Japanese perspective and you made them just like make the most ridiculous story in the world, and you did it on like a Tom Clancy novel, that's what you get with Metal Gear. The stories are ridiculously weird,
yep.
But they're also kind of interesting at the same time.
Yeah, totally.
But they're filled with like the really cheesy dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's so it's such a weird thing that you have to love it.
Fun game, man.
Metal Gear.
Fun game. I don't have a PlayStation, otherwise I might pick it up. Maybe I'll emulate it or something. Who knows?
Do you have a GameCube?
No.
No. You have a Wii?
I got a Switch.
They don't have the old. They made a remake of the first of Metal Gear Solid on GameCube. I had that one.
I mean, I got a PS2 emulator on my phone, so maybe I'll just pick up a copy. Whatever.
It would be a fun thing to play.
Yeah.
Metal Gear. What's the? It's like the end of Metal Gear. The end of Metal Gear Solid. There's always like a recap at the end where the bad guys are speaking over the phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His Metal Gear Solid, it ends with the president being a bad guy. He's like, yeah, dude, you wish Mr. President. And that's like the end, big twist. it's so funny. Yeah, that is interesting. So, all right. You want to move on to the next story?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, this is a funny one. So Benjamin Netanyahu, I guess the current dictator of Israel.
Oh, man.
Does he have that title yet?
I don't know.
Did he take that title yet?
I don't know.
Because once coronavirus hit, he's like, oh, I need to take all the power. No more elections. No more court. Courts are closed. Everything's closed. I'm just for everyone's safety. he's the most shameless politician on earth.
One of
the most shameless politicians on earth. We're at a point where you're just like, I kind of respect it. he's so brazen. He's also enormously popular in Israel, but he shared a fake video. So, all right, I'll peel this back. So he was, he claimed that he had evidence that Iran was covering up coronavirus deaths. And the evidence was from a Hallmark series called Pandemic.
Oh, man, you can't make this shit up. It's hilarious. Oh, man. We got to link speechless. That in the notes or something like that. That's hilarious.
You see, Iran is covering up deaths. Look at this footage. look at them. They're putting. It's.
That's
Mr.
hilarious.
Mr. Netanyahu, that is from the film Jurassic Park.
You see, Iran has, look, they're breeding these creatures. It's a Velociraptor.
They are 6 months away from the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
God, I just thought that was hilarious.
Yeah.
All right, other world leaders
that are taking power.
the president of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov. This happened like a week ago. He said this, but he says anyone who breaks coronavirus quarantine should be executed.
I mean, it's fucked up that we're laughing at it, but Jesus.
That guy's crazy.
Yeah, he's a nutball.
You ever see a picture of him?
No, actually. Let me. I've only read.
He looks like Jaime Lannister. He looks like Jaime Lannister went to Syria to fight in Idlib.
Okay.
Just click on it.
Hold on. I'm going to Google his name just so I can see.
Just go Google image. Ramzan, Ramzan, space, just president of Chechnya.
Yeah.
And Jaime Lannister went to go fight in Idlib.
Yeah, dude, you're totally right. Yeah. There's a lot of crazy ass stories about this guy too. Cause like we can go down a rabbit hole with this shit. We should probably talk about him at a certain juncture because holy shit, this guy.
He was kind of a dual fighter in the Chechen War. Mm-hmm. Like the first Chechen War, he was anti-Moscow. And then the second one, he was pro-Moscow.
Right.
But his father ended up getting killed they both defected to the pro Moscow side, and his father ended up getting killed while on the Moscow side. It's kind of an interesting story, but he double crossed the resistance to Russia.
Isn't he also like super buddy buddy with Putin now?
Yeah, he used to be anti Putin. Now he's pro Putin.
Yeah.
But he's a very interesting character. All right. Also, the president of the Philippines said that as well.
Yeah, I mean, Duterte or whatever his name is, right?
Yeah, Rodrigo Duterte.
Duterte.
He's like, yeah, he's like,
he's another fucking character.
There were people protesting, and he was like, just kill them all. Like, he's very hardcore. But I guess it makes sense because, you know, Philippines is a series of like 40,000 islands.
Yeah.
I guess you got to rule that place with an iron fist.
I don't know. I disagree with that.
I don't agree with his crack yeah. with killing protesters. I'm just saying it makes logical sense that he would be a nut, especially because in East Asia, you know, they're right there in like prime jihad areas because that's like a hot spot for Islamic terrorism. Right. That entire circle of like Indonesia, Malaysia. In the Philippines, there's a lot of like extreme Islamic terror over there.
Right.
All right. So Russia now gives the United States. Everyone knows this story. Russia is now giving the U.S. foreign aid.
Yeah.
It's so funny that like a bunch of like. You know, hardcore anti-Trumpers, you know, Trump is a puppet of Putin. They're all just like discrediting this, like, oh, just a PR move. Like they're like trying to equate this back to the, you know, the Russia collusion thing. And I'm just like, right. Shut the fuck up. Just let the guy, like we need ventilators.
Exactly, let right? him like,
give
him, shut up.
Let him win his PR victory. Yeah. They're not going to give him any sanction relief or anything like that.
Right.
Like, your hawkish policies towards Russia will continue. Let him just be like, I gave the Americans ventilators. They still put the sanction on this.
Nuts. So. Nuts. Absolutely nuts. Related story. But
it's hilarious though because the U.S. gave Russia used to give Russia foreign aid mm-hmm. back in the 90s when the Soviet Union fell. And now it's reversed. Finally, well, the United States is a foreign welfare recipient.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, we reached that point.
Right.
To none other than Russia.
Among others, but still.
I love wording it like that. Yeah. Like, we are a foreign aid recipient to the Russian Empire.
Related news, you know, New York City is going to run out of ventilators in 6 days, so I'll take the Russian ones.
Well, people are like, well, the Russian ones don't work. The Italians said they didn't work. And I'm like, well, you know, they're like, only 20% of them work. I'm like, well,
it's 20% more than we had.
20% more. Yeah. Yeah. If there's 500 ventilators and there's 20% of that, I'm not good at math on the fly.
It's 100.
But 100. Yeah. That should have been easy. So, man under coronavirus lockdown in Spain tries to fool police by walking a stuffed toy dog.
I didn't see that one. That's funny. I saw the one where a man tried to escape house arrest for coronavirus by wearing a ghillie suit. You know what
a ghillie suit?
You know
what is that?
It's like you ever play like a Call of Duty or whatever, and you go as the sniper class, and he's like in fucking leaves. He's like looks like a bush.
Oh, Jesus.
So, like, he put a fucking bush suit on to like, sneak out of his place.
That's like a Metal Gear Solid stripe or something
yep,
like that.
Exactly. Might as well bust out the cardboard box and just run around the streets that way.
Yeah, why not? You imagine police, like, the exclamation mark goes off.
I mean, you probably get away with the cardboard box. That's better here in New York City, you know? Nobody's gonna...
Yeah, that. Well, no one would think of anything. They just think you're a crazy homeless person.
Yeah.
That's. Hey, man, you got to respect it.
Yeah.
You got to respect the guy who was walking his stuffed animal dog.
It's his emotional support dog.
Yeah. We don't have that yet. Like, you can go outside here in New York.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to be shot. You're not going to be shot upon exit. Like, I was in a park the other day. I sound like – I always talk about the park where I feel like I'm a – I feel like I live in the park like a – well, I live in the park now. But I was in the park the other day, and there's plenty of people like sitting next to each other, and I was like, "Oh, are you sure you want to do that? Social distance. Keep your 6 feet. Do your part. 6 feet apart. Ha." But yeah, I just wrote down police state snitches. I guess I meant, oh yeah, so police state snitches. So I heard that, I just heard this. I didn't read an article about this confirming it yet. I couldn't find one specific, but this is what I heard. I heard that police in Missouri were encouraging residents to tell on their neighbors if they were violating social distancing.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. So is that like the new form of swatting?
That's like, that's North Korea.
Yeah.
That's not, that's North Korea. Like, Nazi tell Germany. On your neighbor, like that's tell on your neighbors.
Yeah. That's Nazi
hey,
Germany.
Is your neighbor not social distancing? Go tell, go call the authorities. I'm pretty sure that if you did that, cops wouldn't come over. Like in New York right now, if I called up police and I was like, hey, my neighbor's not social distancing, he was like 3 feet in front of me instead of the suggested 6 feet, I think you should come and either have a talk with him or even take him away into a specific quarantine zone because he is not taking coronavirus seriously and I feel unsafe.
You know, it's what's funny is that you say that jokingly, but I can imagine that right now police, you know, precincts all over New York City are probably getting tons of those kinds of calls. 100%.
I bet they are. And they're not showing up. I severely doubt that they're attending any of those calls. Let's go bust this up. They don't want to do that right now.
They don't want to risk getting coronavirus over that shit.
I've been walking around, like, I've heard about, like, the police breaking up large gatherings, but from what I've seen, and I'm near, like, I'm in the epicenter of an epicenter. Like I'm near a major hospital.
Yeah.
That has. Did I tell you that down the street from me there is the emergency hospital?
Yeah. No. You
that
did.
Was built.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A block. Outside. I go outside. The makeshift emergency hospital is right outside my apartment.
I'm like 8 blocks away from an emergency center, and it was where the first Brooklyn person died from coronavirus, and now they're. Last I read, they're overrun. So, samesies.
It's crazy. But, I mean, I can walk around. I don't get. There's no. No one's giving me shit. I've seen people who are not social distancing not getting shit from the police. Maybe in other areas they are, but at least where I'm at, I haven't seen anything like that aggressive, as of yet.
I was in the park recently and. I just took the walk from my place to my girlfriend's and I cut through the park cause it's a shortcut and there was like a ton of people out there like working out and shit. And like, you know, you got to get your exercise. I get it. But these guys are like, they're on these monkey bars doing pull-ups.
They were Greco-Roman wrestling.
Yeah. No, they were like doing pull-ups and like leg lifts and stuff like that. And I'm like, good on you for doing your fitness. But these dudes are like straight up no gloves. Like they're all, there's like at least 20, 30 of these people like taking turns on the same thing. And I'm like, I hope you guys have hand sanitizer.
Yeah, dude, I saw the same thing.
It's weird. It's weird.
Yeah. And I was thinking, I was like, you don't want to wear gloves?
Right. And then people were playing handball, like ton of people playing handball, like all slapping the same ball, no gloves, you know, shirt off, you know.
When was this?
Just like 2 days ago.
Wow. I'm not seeing that level of comfort up here.
It's weird. It's
that's more of a
weird.
Brooklyn thing.
But it's stupid because Brooklyn's having a really bad problem too. Specifically, like I said, I'm 8 blocks away from, you know.
Well, Brooklyn's having it has it worse than Manhattan, I think, right now, right?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah.
Brooklyn and Queens are taking
a beating, man.
Taking a beating of it. Like Manhattan's pretty bad as well, but like that's where the real shit is going down. Like Elmhurst Hospital is like the ground zero area in Queens. It kind of makes you think of like a zombie apocalypse.
Zombie apocalypse would be much scarier. Much scarier, but yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying.
I also heard a Brooklyn speakeasy was closed.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, again, why would you even want to go to one right now? You know, are you like that bored that you want to just risk it?
I completely understand that. Here's the thing, and I would have been the same way if I was single and I was out and I was young.
Mm-hmm.
I would go fucking crazy in this. Like, I would go fucking nuts.
Well, you know, I read that sex toy sales are on the rise right now.
Okay.
And I propose that we bring back Chatterbait.
Chatterbait? Why don't we all start using Chat Roulette more?
Yep.
You ever use Chat Roulette?
No, I never. You know, when Chat Roulette was, like, popular, I didn't have a computer, believe it or not. So I never got to do it. But I heard it was just a bunch of dicks, like literally
it was
dicks.
100% dicks. All of them. It would just be dick, 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 dick. And then, oh, person. Oh, never mind. He took his dick out. Dick, dick, dick.
It's like,
dick.
I totally love the idea, right? Like if it wasn't like 90% dick, like I think that's kind of cool.
99%
dick. If it wasn't 99% dick, if it was maybe like 20% dick, then I would be like, all right, cool. Let's like have a random 90-second conversation with some fucking rando. That would be cool.
Hey, where are you from?
Dick.
I'm from Missouri. Oh, I'm from Kansas. Oh, we're right next to each other. What school did you go to? Oh, I went to University of Kansas. Oh, I went to Kansas State. Oh, wow, what a small world. Okay, next person. Oh, dick. So that was a weird, you can only expect that any type of social face sharing or webcam app is going to be polluted by exhibitionist or just straight out, you know, people who get off on showing their wieners.
Right.
The strangers.
Or lady wieners.
It's
going to
be subverted by that wieners, crowd immediately. You know?
Yeah, but still, like, how could you, I don't understand how people could be that bored that they're like, you know what? Coronavirus doesn't sound so bad. I'm trying to get laid tonight. You know, like, Jesus,
dude, if you're 23 years old, 24 years old, single, and that's how I was when I was younger. Like, I just wanted to go out all the time and just meet chicks that, you don't give a fuck. You're just like, I'm young. If I get corona, who gives a shit? It'll be a funny story. That's how young people are.
Yeah.
You know that. That's how the people in their early 20s are.
Yeah. I hear that.
I bet I would be able to convince you to do that. If we were both
23.
If
we were
both 23
years old,
we had just first moved to New York and we were stuck in our apartments in Coronaville, I'd be trying to convince you to, like, hey, let's go to this speakeasy.
Yeah.
Return into a new prohibition state.
Yeah.
It's like the era of Al Capone all over again. Except now it's a deadly virus.
Just stay at home and play Call of Duty, guys. Just do your Fortnite, you know.
There's a bunch of books that you could read. If you're going to read some books, I would recommend. Yeah, this could be a whole. All right, here's the thing. This is what we'll do. So I have good news. One announcement to make about Bro History. I finally finished uploading all the podcasts to the YouTube channel, so we're caught up. Which means that we're toying with the idea of doing like live streaming and things like that. Neither of us know how to work the live streaming thing.
We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out. Or at the very least, to combine the live streaming with our audio recording app. So we're gonna figure out the technical details. I guess we'll be doing more stuff on that YouTube channel, kind of random weird topics. So I guess we could do a what books you should read if you have time to type thing, or I don't know, what video games to play. I don't know. We'll think of something that's entertaining. So yeah, check for the YouTube channel that you can subscribe to with the link in this description. And that's pretty much all I have to say.
Yeah.
Rate and review the podcast too.
100%.
If you haven't, rate and review the show. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Stay safe out there. Stay safe.
Social distance.
Don't lick any poles. Don't leave your house at all and just hide underneath your bed for the next 3 months. That's how we're going to beat this thing.